Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will return next week. On today's program, we'll hear a speech by longtime peace and social justice activist Madea Benjamin. She discusses recent victories and setbacks for the anti-war movement and explains her latest campaigns. Please stay tuned.
By criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled the capacity.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Today we hear a speech by longtime peace activist Madea Benjamin. She's co-founder of the women's peace group Code Pink and the fair trade organization Global Exchange. She's been involved with campaigns against U.S. occupation of Iraq, the Israeli occupation of Palestine, Guantanamo Bay prison, and targeted killings by drone aircraft. She's also the author of numerous books. Madea Benjamin spoke this past March at Sonoma State University in Northern California as part of the campus's Social Justice Week, which were in part sponsored by Project Censored. The title of her talk was Challenging Global Power and Inequality. Here's Madea Benjamin.
Thank you so much for the invitation to come here. How many of you here participated in some protest against the Iraq War? And how many of you didn't? And how many of you were too young to have done it? Code Pink started right after the 9/11 attacks. And we were part of a mobilization globally that said, wait, this is not the way to go. Stop, don't do it. I don't know about you, but I sure wish that George Bush would have listened to us. Because if you think what has transpired since then and how it is affecting the world every single day. I mean, just think of the Belgian attacks. Those wouldn't have happened were it not for the US invasion of Iraq. The Paris attacks wouldn't have happened were it not for the invasion of Iraq. ISIS would not exist today were it not for the invasion of Iraq. So much of what is happening in the Middle East and then the reverberations here at home and in Europe is because of the invasion of Iraq. And that's what got us started as Code Pink, and that's what got so many people started. There's a wonderful video, if you haven't seen it, called We Are Many. Anybody see that? Oh, it's really great. You could probably find it online now. It was done by somebody in the UK, and he traced all of these protests that happened around the world on February 15th, 2003, when the world said no to war. And he says that it was the largest day of demonstrations ever in the history of humanity, where people all across the globe stood up and said, this is the disastrous policy, don't do it, don't go to war, it will be terrible. Now think about it, that so many millions of people knew that it was a bad thing. So many millions of people who are not foreign policy experts, who hadn't been briefed by the Pentagon or the CIA, they all knew that it was the wrong thing to do. And yet, we had so many people in our Congress, in our government, and even Hillary Clinton, who didn't know it was the wrong thing to do. And I bring this up as the beginning of my talk because it was the beginning of Code Pink. And we knew enough to not only say this war will be disastrous, but we wanted to get a real grounding about it by going to Iraq. And that's one of the first things that we did, was to get a group of women together to say, let's go to this country where the US is about to bomb and see what those people think about it. And I'll never forget that trip because it had such an incredible impression on me. As much as I try not to have stereotypes about what people in other countries are like, you thought Saddam Hussein, terrible dictator, repressive, you know, what are we gonna find there? And what we found was a vibrant society, yes, repressed by a dictator, but they found all kinds of ways to go around him. They found all kinds of ways to be getting themselves an education. We met women who had PhDs. We met women who were doctors and lawyers and teachers. And my first encounter with Iraqi woman was somebody who came up to say to me, "Oh, you're American. Which of the black women poets is your favorite? I've been reading Nikki Giovanni, I've been reading Alice Walker," and she went on to name all these black women poets that I didn't even know. And I was amazed and said to her, "You must have studied in the United States." And she had beautiful English. She said, "I've never been out of Iraq, but I love poetry, and I've been studying this at the university in Baghdad." And that is just one example of the amazing women that we met. And yeah, they didn't like Saddam Hussein. And yeah, they wanted to overthrow a dictator. And you know what they said to us? They said, "Let us do that. That is our job as Iraqis. You can't bring democracy through missiles and bombs. It has to be brought by the people themselves." And I look back at that with such anguish and think of all the wonderful people that we've met over the years going back to Iraq and how disastrous their lives have turned out. Almost all of them are either dead or living in other countries in exile. And think of the millions of people whose lives have been affected by that invasion. And as we mourn people in Paris, San Bernardino, as we mourn people in Brussels, let's remember the huge number of people that we killed. We killed those people, we displaced those people. And there has been absolutely no accountability. And that's something that as Code Pink, I would say we're one of the only organizations, unfortunately, that keeps saying, what about the accountability for the Iraq invasion? Why is it that from George Bush to Donald Rumsfeld to Dick Cheney to Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, they all have their memoirs, and they go out speaking with their memoirs, and they make tons of money speaking, and they're considered these great statespeople? Why? They're war criminals. There should be tribunals where they should be brought before tribunals, and they should be given a fair trial for the crimes that they committed. And unfortunately, when you are the most powerful country, you don't have to be accountable. But yet people around the world, and especially in the Middle East, ask about that. They ask about why it is that the U.S. can constantly get away with destroying other countries, killing people, no due process, nothing. And we think there won't be blowback for that? It doesn't make any sense. So when I look at the policies over these past 14 years, it breaks my heart to think how badly we have reacted to the 9/11 attacks. How we should have treated it like a crime against humanity and gone after the individuals who attacked us. And you know what? If we went after the individuals who attacked us, we would also be led to a country that is the greatest U.S. ally in the Middle East, in the Arab world, and that is Saudi Arabia. Now, I've been doing a lot of work these past years, going to Yemen, going to Afghanistan, going to Iraq, going to Pakistan, going to Egypt, and everywhere I go, people ask, why is the U.S. such a close ally of Saudi Arabia if you're going to pick one country most responsible for the 9/11 attacks? And why isn't your peace movement doing anything about this? And that's what led me most recently to be focusing on Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 hijackers from Saudi Arabia. Money from Saudi Arabia going to fuel extremism. And the foundation of the state of Saudi Arabia comes from a pact between a reactionary, intolerant sect within Islam called Wahhabism, and a Saudi family. And when they made the pact together, they said, okay, we're going to use this religion as a way to justify us taking over this Arabian Peninsula, and then when oil was discovered, to use that oil wealth for a very, very small group of people, the Saud family, the kings and the princes, and use this Wahhabi religion as an excuse, really. And it, had it not been for the petrodollars, Wahhabism would have been a small, small sect that probably would have disappeared. And were it not for the US that came in and said, aha, we need that oil, the Saud family and that dynasty would most likely have been overthrown. So we have to take a lot of responsibility for the fact that over decades and 12 different presidents, Republicans and Democrats alike, our military has supported and provided security for this repressive regime. And just to give you a sense of how repressive that regime is, there are absolutely no political parties, no freedom of association, no freedom of speech. I mean, I showed the video before you came in of this guy doing a parody of a No Women, No Cry to the tune, making it No Women, No Drive. But that's as much as you can get away with in Saudi Arabia. You go a little step further than that and you will be in prison. I don't know if you heard the case of Raif Badawi, a blogger, for blogging some mild criticisms that he'd like a government that was more democratic, given 15 years in prison and sentenced to 1,000 lashes. 1,000 lashes. So they took him out one day and they take people to public squares to do the lashing, and they start beating on this guy. Well, somebody filmed it and put it out to the world. And there was such a huge reaction against this that that's the one positive thing I can say, is that we in the international community haven't managed to free Raif Badawi, but we've managed to stop him from getting flogged another 950 times. And there are three young men who are part of the Shia community, which is a minority in Saudi Arabia. They were protesting as part of the Arab Spring, came to Saudi Arabia, and they said, we have been repressed for so long, we're gonna go out and protest, non-violent protests. They were arrested, one of them 15 years old and two of them 17 years old. They are on death row. And they have not only been sentenced to execution, they've been sentenced to beheading, and one of them to crucifixion. Now, when I heard that, I said, what does that mean, crucifixion? And what it means is you first get your head cut off, and then you get put up on a pole with the head separate, dangling from there, and put out there for days for the public to see this. And of course, this is a warning for the rest of the community to say, don't you dare do this. And one of the young men, Ali Al-Nimr, his uncle is a very famous Sheikh Nimr, who was recently executed, again, as an example to that whole community. So we have super repressive regime, no fair trials, torture, confessions under torture used to convict people to death penalty, the country that is the number one beheader in the world, that doesn't not only allow women to drive, I mean, that's just the tiny part of it, has a system called a guardianship system, where no matter how old you are always a minor. You can be 70, 80 years old, you are a minor, and you always need a man to give you consent for doing things in your life, whether it's to get an education, to go to college, to get married, get divorced, to bring a court case. Employers use it, asking a male guardian to give you the right to travel, all kinds of things. You need a man to vouch for you.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Today, we're listening to a speech by Medea Benjamin given at Sonoma State University this past March. After the break, we'll return to that speech. Stay with us.
Saudi Arabia is a country that's built on foreign labor. A third of the population comes from other countries. And some of the worst abuses of migrant labor in the world occur in Saudi Arabia because it's a sponsorship system. So if you want to get somebody to clean your house for you, you recruit them through a recruiting firm that then brings a person, let's say, from the Philippines. They live in your house and you work them 10, 12 hours, 14 hours a day. If the person realizes, uh-oh, I made a big mistake. These people are really mean to me. They're not paying me what they said they would pay me. I get beaten. I want to go home. You can't go home. You can't go home unless your employer gives you the right to go home. That's how bad it is. So this is a country that's built on these terrible relationships among people. And where the United States had agreed to support this system because it had oil. Well, things have changed since then because the U.S., there's a glut in the oil market. And so we don't need the Saudi oil anymore. In fact, only 10% of the oil coming into this country is from Saudi Arabia. Well, so why do we keep this relationship? One thing I would say is that it's because they have become the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons. And this is part of the vicious cycle of the military-industrial complex and the weapons industry that keeps us in a perpetual state of war. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, they are using the weapons now for war they've been waging in the poorest country in the Arabian Peninsula, and that is Yemen. And the Saudis for the last year have been constantly bombing Yemen. And I hope, Peter, this is one of your unreported Project Censored stories this year. Is it maybe? Probably. Let's hope so, because the US media has written almost nothing about Yemen. And the issue about Yemen is that the Saudis have come in, gotten involved in an internal dispute in this very poor country, and they are using our weapons to be bombing hospitals and marketplaces and schools and residences. And the majority of people who are being killed are civilians. And not only are they just using weapons, they're also using a weapon that's been banned by the international community, and that's cluster bombs, made in the United States, sold to the Saudis, and used against international law. So we have a lot to account for in terms of supporting this regime, but unfortunately, it is part of this cycle of militarism. So I do want to talk during the discussion about some of the campaigns and some of the ideas we have about how we can stop weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, how we can support the human rights activists in Saudi Arabia. Raise your hand if you were excited about Obama being in Cuba. So Obama going to Cuba is a huge breakthrough. And one of the things Obama did when he was in Cuba, he said, I want to promote human rights activists, and I, as part of the condition to go there, is I want a meeting with those human rights activists. Well, Obama is going to Saudi Arabia on April 21st. Don't you think it would be nice if he met with human rights activists while he's there? So we want to do a whole campaign around that and get all kinds of people involved in pushing Obama to meet with pro-democracy people, dissidents, the human rights community when he's in Saudi Arabia. It would be a huge, huge, huge breakthrough if we were able to do that. So I began by talking about the massive movement we had to try to stop the war with Iraq. That massive movement has unfortunately died out as soon as Obama became president. And when Obama became president, so many people put their hopes that this was going to be a peace president, that he was going to bring peace to the Middle East for us. People were tired from 8 years of protesting Bush. There was a financial crisis. People had lots of other things to do. For all kinds of reasons, our movement really dissipated. And it's been a tough slog for these last 7 years to try to get people involved in the peace movement. It's been very tough to get young people involved in this movement. It's been very tough to get people out on the streets around the issues of the ongoing perpetual wars in the Middle East. But I do want to say that while it's been a tough 7 years, we have had a major, major breakthrough, and that is the nuclear deal with Iran. Now, the nuclear deal with Iran is historic because we could be engaged in yet another war in the Middle East, and this would be a real doozy of a war in the Middle East if we got involved in military engagement in Iran. I look at a wonderful person here sitting in the room, Leslie Balogh, who was with us in Code Pink years ago in Washington, D.C., trying to stop a U.S. bombing of Iran. In fact, did long hunger strikes. How long were your hunger strikes? 24 days. Sitting in offices of people like Joseph Lieberman, trying to get meetings, trying to push for our representatives in Washington to actually talk with Iranians. And we were very involved around the fight to win this nuclear deal. And it was a very difficult fight because the strongest lobby, international foreign policy lobby group in the United States called AIPAC, that is a pro-Israeli government lobby, wanted to quash the deal, as did a lot of other neoconservative groups. And they poured lots of money, tens of millions of dollars, into ads that were put out all over the country, into targeting key members of Senate and the Congress to say, this is a terrible deal. And the community of activists that had been pretty quiet for many years, lots of them came back and started getting involved in this campaign. And I think we did a pretty amazing job targeting senators, targeting congresspeople, saying the American people want diplomacy, we don't want more war. And we were able to defeat these big, big, powerful, moneyed interests and support Obama and John Kerry in the work they did to get the deal through. That was a major breakthrough. It was the first time in a long time that groups like AIPAC had actually been defeated. And it marked an opening for us in Washington to push more for diplomatic solutions. I mentioned Obama going to Cuba, but I think I should say a little bit more about it because, you know, that is history in the making, and it just happened in this past year. Some of us, including myself, have been working on that for many, many, many decades. And it doesn't just happen that a president says, okay, I'm going to change U.S. policy. It comes from a long, sometimes very slow slog of trying to open up relations, of citizen diplomacy, of trying to change public opinion so that leaders then feel that their backs are covered when they make policy changes. And I see my old colleague June Brashear is here, who I work with for a long time in Global Exchange, where we've been working for years, taking people to Cuba constantly. At one point, I think we had about 80 trips a year that we were doing. I don't know how the hell we ever did that. But, you know, building up people-to-people ties. How many people in this audience have ever been to Cuba? So quite a number in a small group. It's that kind of diplomacy, it's that kind of work that opens the doors to things like the historic change we see in U.S. relations in Cuba. I mean, seeing an embassy in Washington, D.C., and we were there when the flag went up, was just a moment of tremendous joy. Seeing a U.S. flag going up in Havana and the turning of that into an embassy, also a moment of joy. Any time that we can push the people in power to do something that puts diplomacy over hostilities should be a time of tremendous joy for us in the United States. So those were two major successes that we've had in a pretty bleak landscape for the peace movement. A bleak landscape, I would say, it doesn't get much bleaker than Syria. And Syria is a disaster for everybody. It's a lose-lose. There is no winners except the weapons manufacturers in the case of Syria. And in fact, U.S. weapon manufacturers are supplying weapons to all sides that are fighting each other. But for the people of Syria, it's been an absolute catastrophe for the global community that we haven't been able to stop this. Has been a catastrophe. And it's been very difficult to get the peace movement going on this because there are big differences over how people see the issue and where we could find common ground and what we could do. And in fact, one of the only things that we thought we could do as Code Pink was to push for the peace talks to happen and to try to get women at the table at those peace talks. And when the first peace talks were announced in Geneva, we got together with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Some of you might know that group, WILF, and a couple of other women's groups, and said, let's try to get women at the peace table. After all, the United Nations has for many years said and passed a resolution called 1327 that said women must be at the table for peace talks. Women have to be involved in the process. And not just because it's our right to be there, it's because when you have women there, there's a much greater likelihood that you will actually come to an agreement. And we worked with 40 Syrian women on different sides of the issue and brought them to Geneva and lobbied hard with John Kerry and the other sides to say, put these women at the peace table, or at least a representative, or two or three women at the peace table. And no, it was only men at the peace table. It was only men with guns at the peace table. Women that were not even given observer status at the peace table. And so no wonder there was no positive outcome of those negotiations. And one of the other things I think we could agree on as a peace community is that we had to support the refugees. And there was a lot of work that I was involved in Washington, D.C. to increase the number of refugees from Syria that would be able to come to the United States. We weren't very successful on that. But we were successful in getting a lot more money from the U.S. to go towards helping humanitarian aid for the Syrian refugees. Unfortunately, I think when you look at Syria, what you really have to say is that we in the peace movement have not been able to respond at the level that the crisis demands. And we still haven't.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Today, we're airing a speech by Medea Benjamin. She spoke last March during Social Justice Week at Sonoma State University in Northern California. Project Censored was one of the co-sponsors. We now return to the speech by Medea Benjamin.
Another area that I wanted to talk about where we have had some impact is around Israel and Palestine. Now, I don't know how many of you follow this closely enough to have known that the lobby group AIPAC had its yearly meeting last week. But it became a big issue because they invite all of the presidential candidates to speak. And Donald Trump agreed to speak. Ted Cruz agreed to speak. Kasich agreed to speak. Hillary Clinton agreed to speak. There was one candidate who did not agree to speak. And how ironic that it is the Jewish candidate who refused to speak there. The candidate who's actually spent significant time in Israel refused to speak there, and that was Bernie Sanders. And yeah, I think that deserves some applause because it actually took a lot of guts to say, I'm too busy to speak at AIPAC. And he said, I would be willing to speak remotely, and I will give you the text of what I would say. And what he said is what no other candidate said. He mentioned the word Palestine and the Palestinians. The other candidates didn't even bother to talk about the Palestinians. It is such a twisted political scene when it comes to Israel-Palestine in this country that just to say that you are for human rights of all people, including the Palestinians, is like a major breakthrough. Just to say that you think it is terrible that the Israelis continue to illegally increase the number of settlements because it makes it harder and harder and harder to ever think of a way out of this morass takes tremendous political courage in this country. And I don't know if you got a chance to listen to the speeches, but they were just terrible. And I will single out, not because it was the worst, but because one would want better, the speech of Hillary Clinton. And what I found so demoralizing in her speech is that the one movement globally that is a nonviolent movement to try to support the efforts of the Palestinians for justice is called Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, the BDS movement. It's a movement that's based on long traditions, whether it's Cesar Chavez and the farm workers here or the anti-apartheid movement, but its roots are in struggles for justice all over the world. And it is a movement that has caught momentum in places as far away as South Africa, to all over Europe, to here in the United States. And when I say that the peace movement has really lost a lot of its steam, there is one area of the peace movement, and that is around Israel and Palestine, that has a lot of momentum, particularly among young people on campuses, and that is the BDS movement. The Students for Justice in Palestine are very strong on campuses around the country, and they've come under tremendous attack. And the lobby that is connected to AIPAC has tried to equate justice for Palestine with anti-Semitism. It is untrue. It is a terrible thing to try to equate those things, but that's what they have been doing, and they've been going after students and attacking them and trying to stop BDS movements on campuses. And Hillary Clinton fed right into that. She told students on campus to stay strong in fighting against BDS on the campuses. Fighting against a nonviolent movement that says that we should not keep supporting illegal activities of Israel. And I just felt so horrible when I heard her say that, and the message that that sends to students on campuses who are rising up in this justice movement. But despite that, there have been many wins in this BDS movement on a global level, and very recently. In fact, there is a company from the UK called G4S that has been involved in selling equipment that's used on in the prisons and used at checkpoints. And they recently said they would be canceling and not doing any new contracts in Israel because it was so bad for their reputation. There's a company, Veolia, a French company, that was building trams that would go take people from settlement to settlement. And these are trams that connected illegal settlements, but of course that Palestinians could not use. And after years of a campaign, they finally said they were breaking ties with the Israeli contract. We at Code Pink for 7 years have been focusing on a cosmetic company called Ahava that was being produced in illegal settlements and was taking minerals from the Dead Sea to use for products that were being sold as if they were made in Israel. And we said, they are not made in Israel, they're made in occupied Palestine. And we had campaign that would range from going into stores where we were dressed, either the young people in their bikinis, some of us older women in our robes, as if we were going to a spa with our head in towels and putting the mud that they sell and saying that Ahava is dirty, that stealing people's lands is dirty, and Ahava means love, and our campaign was there's no love in stolen land. And we got places after places to say they would no longer carry Ahava because it just wasn't worth it for them. And then most recently, we had a real win, which is the company said they were going to move their factory off of an illegal settlement. And that is a great victory for us. Just as it was a great victory, a campaign around SodaStream that we worked on, a group called Jewish Voice for Peace worked on, and finally, after a lot of pressure, you know what SodaStream is? Mm-hmm. That, yeah. No?
Fizzy some people? Water.
Yeah, fizzy water. Something we really need. They finally said they were also going to move their factory off of illegal settlement. We have two campaigns that we're working on now. One is around RE/MAX. You know, RE/MAX is a real estate company, and they are selling homes in illegal settlements. In fact, until we started our campaign, you could go online and you could pick an illegal settlement and go on there and see these homes for sale that were million-dollar homes with pools and, you know, beautiful view of Palestinian lands. And it was just so sad to see this. Now they've taken a lot of them off because they don't want people to see, but we still are pressuring, because we haven't won that campaign yet, for RE/MAX to stop selling homes in illegal settlements. There's another campaign kind of similar to that, which is Airbnb. So Airbnb is allowing people to put up for rent homes in and rooms in illegal settlements. And so we have had a very lively campaign around that with all kinds of great satires about it and YouTubes. And we've been trying to meet with people in the Airbnb headquarters. And I think it's going to be a successful campaign because I think we've been putting a lot of pressure on that company. So these are examples of nonviolent tactics that can work and are very important to be supporting, and I hope those of you who haven't been involved will sign up, and maybe we could talk about some things that people could do to support those campaigns. A few other things that I wanted to mention. When I talked about Saudi Arabia, the military-industrial complex, and how it keeps us in this constant state of war. Well, when you talk to members of Congress about trying to cut a particular weapons system or talk about the need to reduce the Pentagon budget, one of the responses they will have is that it creates jobs. Now, this is actually absurd because anything will create jobs if you throw billions of dollars into it. In fact, there was a great study done by the University of Massachusetts that compared for every $1 billion, how many jobs you would get if you put the money into education, or you put the money into healthcare, or you put the money into green energy, or I think there was a category if you drop the money from a helicopter. And all of them would create more jobs than if you gave it to the military. The military was the lowest number of jobs per $1 billion spent. And that is because the military is so bad in how it uses its money. You know, there has never been an audit of the Pentagon. You know why? Because the Pentagon can't pass an audit, because the Pentagon loses billions of our dollars. And the other thing is that because it's so consolidated, the weapons industries, there is so little bidding on contracts. Those of you old enough to remember, you might have remembered that Halliburton got a $5 billion no-bid contract before the war in Iraq even began. Dick Cheney, yep. And so the Pentagon is a huge waste of our tax dollars, to say nothing about what the weapons get used for to kill people, just talking about how badly they spend their money. There's a weapon system you might have heard of called the F-35. This is the biggest boondoggle. So far, it has cost us taxpayers $379 billion. Let it sink in, $1 billion. And over the life of this system, it will cost us over $1 trillion. I mean, this could pay for Bernie Sanders' program for free education for everybody for years to come. It's a huge amount of money for a boondoggle of an airplane we don't need, because there are so many we already have, and that has had tremendous problems all the time, years and years, delays and huge cost overruns. You know how much the helmet for a pilot of the F-35 costs? Take a guess. $5,000. That's a reasonable guess. Anybody else want to do a guess? $400,000. That man back there knows. $400,000 for the helmet for the F-35. I mean, remember like the toilet that was the joke, because, you know, it cost $400 for a toilet in the Pentagon? $400,000 for the helmet. I used to live in California. I moved to Washington, D.C. because it's, you know, where so much of the action is. And we go to a lot of hearings. And so 2 days ago, we went to a hearing that was for the F-35. And in that hearing, they talked about what a bargain it is now, because now they've inflated the cost, so then they could say, oh, we're coming in under budget now, after they were over budget for so many years. They also said, and it was in the papers today, that it needs a facelift for the American public, because the American public, if they know about this weapon, they have a pretty negative feeling about it, because it's cost so much and so many overruns. And so what they're doing now is they're going to go around the country to all these, do air shows to show people how great this weapon is and to get a lot of new enthusiasm for this weapon system. So immediately I thought that Code Pink and our allies must go out to every single air show that's happening and show the American people what a horrible waste of our tax dollars this F-35 is. A funny story about this hearing. We were busy with other hearings. There was a Guantanamo hearing going on. And by the way, at the Guantanamo hearing, we were wearing our orange jumpsuits. And I'll digress for a minute, because they wouldn't let us in the hearing with the orange jumpsuits. They said, the chairman says no costumes are allowed inside the hearing. And we said, costume? This is what you put on prisoners. I don't think it's a costume. And they said, we call it a costume. And then a general went by with like a million different things on there. And I said, that looks like a costume. Oh, they didn't like that. And so we were fighting about getting into this hearing. And in the meantime, we took half the costume off and, you know, tucked it in and said, okay, now can we go in? Well, they let us in then. And one of the things in that hearing that happened is that the Pentagon and the State Department actually want to close Guantanamo, and the Congress doesn't want them to close Guantanamo. And so one of the things that came out in that hearing that I thought was quite extraordinary is the person responsible for the Pentagon said, the admirals and generals that we've been talking with say the most effective counterterrorism measure we could take would be to close Guantanamo. So let's come back to that, because that was a digression, because I was telling you about the F-35 story. So there was a line to get into the F-35 hearing, and it was all guys in suits, all men in suits. And because we were busy with the other hearings, there was one Code Pink young woman who was online to get into that hearing. And she texted us and she said, help, you know, I'm the only one online here who's not part of the weapons industry. I've been talking to these people online, and you know, they're all recycled from government into the weapons industry. And I heard them talking about Code Pink, and they were saying how much they hate Code Pink. And she said, they said, I hope nobody from Code Pink shows up at these hearings, because we hate those people. They come in and they talk bad about our weapon system, and they hold up signs in the hearings, and they're so horrible, and they get these young women who know nothing about any of these issues, and they pay these women to sit in the hearings and hold up signs. So she's listening to all of this. So she waits until the doors open, and she gets inside the hearing room, and she takes off her jacket, and she has a coat pink shirt on, and she gets up and she says to them, "By the way, nobody paid me to come to this hearing. I'm an intern with Code Pink, and it's a very competitive thing to be able to win an internship with Code Pink. And I'm really proud that I am, and I know a lot about these issues." I thought that was quite beautiful.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're listening to a speech by longtime peace activist Medea Benjamin. We now return to the speech.
So, talking about these weapon systems, I was reading the paper on my way here in the plane, and this full-page ad in the Washington Post, there's one like this almost every day. It's from either Northrop Grumman or Lockheed Martin. This one's from Boeing. And it's to glorify the military. And who do you think pays for these ads? I mean, this is us, right? This is our money. You know, I'm trying to get an ad in the Washington Post to ask Obama to meet with Saudi democracy advocates when he goes. It's going to cost like $70,000 to get an ad in. And we're trying to figure out, you know, how we can pay for that. In the meantime, every day, just about every single day, there is a full-page ad from these weapons manufacturers paid for by our tax money. This glorification of the military is everywhere. I took Southwest Airlines the other day. And Southwest Airlines, when you're about to go on the plane, they say, okay, pre-boarding. Now, pre-boarding, they're not saying people with little children, they're not saying people who can't walk, the wheelchair. Pre-boarding, members of the military, pre-board. And we want to thank you for your service. Now, I don't know about you, but that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And I got up and I said, are there any teachers in the area here? Why don't you pre-board and we want to thank you for your service? Are there any healthcare workers here? Are there any environmentalists here trying to save the planet? Why don't you pre-board? We have to counter the militarism, the glorification of the military everywhere. We find it because it's so pervasive in our world, in our community, and living in DC, boy, it's really, really pervasive. So I wanted to mention another article that was in today's paper. And this is something that I found just lovely. It's called Millennials Embrace Socialism. Now, something that should give us a lot of hope. Because just think before Bernie's campaign, socialism. And people were afraid to say they were socialists. And along comes Bernie Sanders, and he says, yeah, I'm a socialist. And what they find in this article is that more people under 30 had a favorable perception of socialism than they did of capitalism. Now that is extraordinary. Now the article says they don't know what socialism is. They think it's something like Scandinavia. And I think it's part of that talking down to young people. Just like those men in their suits online said that the Code Pink young women didn't know what they were talking about. I think a lot of young people do know what they're talking about. So who in this room is under 30 and who would consider yourself favorable to socialism? All right, so why don't you give us a reason why?
It's a step in the right direction of putting people's rights before money.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? All right, I'll say not under 30 anymore. Who has a favorable view of socialism and would like to say why?
It's a way of acknowledging that we don't really want such strong capitalism. So whether it's for socialism, I think it's more against capitalism.
I think you're right. I think a lot of people are saying the system we have now is not working for us. Maybe we should look for something else.
People don't say this very often, but I actually think because it's cheaper. Because you don't have to skim off profits.
It's kind of becoming a mantra right now, but I believe that it would put people and planet before profit.
Because democracy shouldn't end when you go into the workplace. It should be at the workplace as well.
Well, we practice socialism, really. It's not that far away from us, really, with libraries, our free education, grade school, high school. We have that. We have police department, fire department. That's all socialism, our social security cards. So, you know, it's just embellishing on that, really, and going back to the free education, because I remember 40 years ago at City College, it was pretty free. I think it only cost a few dollars to go to City College.
I just want to see if there's anybody else that wants to say why they would look at an alternative. Yeah.
Thank you. I teach literature, and I've always taught socialism and Marxism in my classes for 18 years here. And what I always teach the students is that it's about values. And capitalism only values what can be produced and sold and marketed. And we end up feeling like we have to beg those people for the things that we really value, which are the things of compassion and empathy and caring and all those people that you want to honor at the airport. So thank you for saying that too.
So we know that the wealthy already have socialism. I think everyone else should have socialism too.
I say the military is the largest socialist institution in the world. I didn't do that to push socialism necessarily. It's because I think it's great that young people are looking for alternatives. And we are in a moment that it's scary when you look at Donald Trump and all the support that he's getting. On the other hand, it's also positive that people are against the establishment, whether it's on the side of Bernie or Trump. People don't like the status quo. And I think it's really exciting that so many young people have gotten involved and are questioning why they should graduate in debt when it's not happening in other countries. People questioning why, as good as we can get, is Obamacare really, when there's much better systems around. People questioning why we're not putting the F-35, $379 billion into green energy instead of into weapon systems we don't need. People questioning why our police are militarized, why we are killing so many young people of color, and why we are incarcerating so many of them, and why we've allowed it to become a for-profit industry to put people in prison, whether they are in immigration detention centers or other prison facilities. How obscene is that, to have people make a profit by incarcerating people? So it's a time when a lot of young people are questioning a lot of things. And that, to me, is the most hopeful thing that I see. I've lived in countries that have called themselves socialist, including Cuba, and I've seen a lot of problems, lots and lots and lots of problems. When the state takes too much control, when you don't have a kind of vibrant civil society where people can really put pressure on the government. So we need hybrid systems. And I think that's what Bernie is talking about, hybrid systems. And I just wanted to end my talk now by saying, when you look for hybrid systems, we have to look at the good and bad in our own system and the good and bad in other systems. And I was really quite amazed that Barack Obama, when he was in Cuba, said, "We accept and welcome criticism of our own country." That was pretty amazing for him to say there. And certainly, he gave lots of criticism of the Cuban system, and much of it well-deserved. But there is a need to learn from others. And that's why I think the Michael Moore film is so fantastic, Where Should We Invade Next? And that's why I think a tiny little country like Cuba can teach us something about values. With an economic system that doesn't work very well, on the other hand, there is a set of values that is quite extraordinary. And I lived in Cuba for a couple of years in the early 80s. And I remember back then my mom, who has since deceased, and I having a conversation about values and who we like, who are our role models. And way back then, my mom, may she rest in peace, said that her role model was Donald Trump back then. And I said my role model was Che Guevara. And they were different. And I, when I lived in Cuba, I rode a bicycle to work. And every day I would go out of my way, going a long way around. And people would say, "Why don't you go the direct route?" And I said, "Because there is a billboard that I like to look at every day on my way to work. I grew up in a capitalist society where the billboards you see are buy this, buy that, buy this, buy that. And this is a different billboard, and it just gives me great joy to go buy it every day." And that billboard was a quote by Che Guevara. And it was at the front of a children's hospital. And it said, "The life of one child is worth more than all the riches of the wealthiest person on earth." And I thought, what a wonderful way to start the day. And I think as we look around and we look at this crazy system that we have and the electoral campaign that is very unique, let's remember that at the basis of it all is a question of values. As you teach your students, is it about wealth? Is it about what you can buy, the power that you can buy? Or is it about community and each other and children and life and love? Let's put those values first. Thank you.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that concludes the Project Censored show for this week. We just heard a speech by longtime peace activist Medea Benjamin. The Project Censored show is heard on over 35 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. Please follow and like us on Facebook and learn more at projectcensored.org. I'm Mickey Huff. We'll see you next time. We got the love.